Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 16th of May, these are our main stories. Brazil's new health minister has resigned after just a few weeks over President Bolsonaro's handling of the coronavirus crisis. Donald Trump has announced plans to speed up the development of a vaccine in what he said was the biggest government-wide project since the first nuclear weapons were made. And the European Union has said it will try to block any Israeli attempt to annex parts of the occupied West Bank. Also in this podcast...
It was in Hamburg that the Beatles truly learned their craft and developed their image. And the person who caught it on camera was a 22-year-old photographer, Astrid Kircher.
The photographer who took the first pictures of the Beatles and made famous their iconic mop-top hairstyles has died, aged 81. We begin in Brazil, where President Jair Bolsonaro is now looking for another new health minister after the incumbent, who'd been in post only a month, resigned. It followed disagreements with the government over its handling of the coronavirus crisis. Over the last week, about 700 people a day have died with COVID-19 in Brazil. That's the highest daily death rate after the United States. On Friday, Nelson Teich spoke to the media.
A vida é feita de escolhas, e eu hoje escolhi sair.
Life is made of choices, and today I chose to leave. I can say that I gave the best of myself the days that I was here during this period. It is not simple to be in a ministry like this one during such a difficult period.
Our correspondent in Sao Paulo, Katie Watson, was listening.
Well, he didn't give any indication what those difficulties were. He just talked about how well the team had operated in the time he had been health minister, which is less than a month. But the general consensus was that he disagreed with the use of chloroquine in the early stages of coronavirus, the importance of social distancing. And that was something that, of course, led to the demise of the previous health minister, Luis Enrique Mandetta. It was something that the president was at odds with Mandetta, and it seems like he was at odds with the health minister. At the end of the day, Jair Bolsonaro is at odds with global health recommendations. So this is a big challenge for the next person in charge of the health portfolio. That's going to be the biggest challenge, really.
When he was appointed after his predecessor was sacked, presumably Mr. Bolsonaro was under the impression that he had him on board.
Mandetta was very outspoken, especially towards the end. He was very critical of Jair Bolsonaro. The feeling was that Mr. Taichi would be a bit more in line with Jair Bolsonaro. That said, he is still a medical doctor with a business background, certainly, but still a doctor. And to be able to disagree with what the rest of the world is doing was always going to be a difficult a challenge. And it clearly, he went down the medical route rather than listening to his boss. The defining moment this week was when Jair Bolsonaro issued a decree adding gyms, beauty salons, hairdressers, barbers as on the list of essential services. And when a journalist at a press conference said, you know, what do you think about this list? He looked puzzled, he looked surprised, and said that this was not something the health ministry was consulted on. And at that point, you realised how the lack of unity within the government, even not even addressing and going to the health ministry on this decision, really made clear how difficult it is to be working in the health ministry at the moment.
So where does this leave Brazil then? The number of cases still rising.
And that's the big concern, the vacancy of health minister at a point when really Brazil needs some leadership to be able to steer it through this crisis. At the moment, we're talking on a state level. Each state is deciding how to either lock down, introduce quarantine. In some states, they've started opening up again further in the south. The lack of unity, the confusion, just means that people don't respect guidelines because they don't really know which guidelines to listen to. Then you've got the added issue of people here in a developing country, huge amounts of poverty, need to go back to work or feel they're desperate for some kind of government help that they're not getting. So you've got all of that added in the mix, people starting to flout social isolation guidelines, and at a point when the numbers are rising and the cases are rising of deaths and of confirmed cases, the whole system seems to be falling apart just at the wrong time.
Katie Watson in Sao Paulo. President Trump has announced a new initiative with the private sector in the US to speed up the development of a vaccine against the coronavirus. Here's what he said in the Rose Garden at the White House.
I want to update you on the next stage of this momentous medical initiative. It's called Operation Warp Speed. That means big and it means fast. A massive scientific, industrial, and logistical endeavor, unlike anything our country has seen since the Manhattan Project. You really could say that nobody's seen anything like we're doing, whether it's ventilators or testing. Nobody's seen anything like we're doing now within our country since the Second World War. Incredible.
Our Washington correspondent Gary O'Donoghue told us about that drive to get a vaccine by the end of the year.
The president is a master at peppering everything with superlatives, isn't he? And this speech was an example of that kind. He's saying a vaccine by the end of the year. People he's hired, including a former vaccine chief from GlaxoSmithKline, which is a British pharmaceutical company, he says that is a credible idea, but extremely challenging. What they're also doing is trying to address, I think, some of the things that are within their control, such as trying to get production facilities up to speed so that if they do get a vaccine, or even more than one vaccine, because it may end up being, you know, two or three of these things, a cocktail, some directed at some people, some at others, that they have the ability to produce them in the numbers and distribute them. So that's what this is really all about. I think that's, you know, been happening to some extent, but this is a new push and a new attempt at coordinating that effort.
Now, we also heard today a warning about one of the tests that's being used in the US to detect the coronavirus, and it could be inaccurate.
Yeah, and this is the Abbott test made by a company called Abbott. This is the one that was actually used at the White House for the staff there and journalists and indeed the president. And it's a 15-minute test, and you take a swab and you stick it in a machine. Now, some researchers at New York University have said they found up to 48% inaccuracy in terms of false negatives for this test. Having said that, this research has not been peer-reviewed, and the manufacturers of the Abbott machine say that the study wasn't carried out in the right way. They criticise, for example, transporting the samples in a particular kind of liquid, as you normally do if you were testing remotely, whereas they say you have to put these straight in the machine. Anyway, whatever, the regulator, the FDA, has said that it may be necessary to do second tests if you get a negative, just to confirm it, and they say they've given fresh advice to the White House. But these things have been on display at White House press briefings, and they're in use all around the country as well.
That was Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. The United States is introducing new rules that will further restrict the operations of the Chinese telecoms firm Huawei, which Washington considers a security risk. Michael Bristow reports.
The US says foreign firms that use American technology to make semiconductors for Huawei will in future need a license. US companies are already subject to similar restrictions. The move could have a serious impact on Huawei's worldwide business, which depends on foreign semiconductors for its smartphones and telecom equipment. China's Global Times said Beijing could respond by targeting American companies such as Apple and Boeing. The row over Huawei is just one of several that's led to a marked deterioration in the relationship between China and the United States.
That was Michael Bristow. In Colombia, prisoners say they're being left to die as the country's overcrowded penal system struggles to cope with the spread of coronavirus. Riots in prisons across the country in late March left 24 inmates dead and more than 80 seriously injured. Colombia's government has been accused of indifference, but it denies it's ignoring the crisis. An emergency decree at the beginning of April said 4,000 of the least dangerous convicts would be released and placed under house arrest. But more than a month later, fewer than 300 cases have been processed. Matthew Charles reports from Bogota.
Prisoners panicking and on the rampage in March. They're vulnerable and terrified of catching COVID-19. They want the government to listen to them. Colombia's prisons are designed to hold about 78,000 convicts, but the current prison population is almost 120,000. Social distancing is impossible. In Villavicencio, a few hours southeast of Bogotá, the prison is the worst hit by coronavirus, with more than 800 confirmed cases and 2 deaths. Almost 2,000 inmates are locked up in a facility that's supposed to hold 874.
En el patio hay 1,300 personas privadas de la libertad.
48-year-old Juan, not his real name because he fears repercussions, has tested positive for COVID-19. But he's not been placed in isolation, and he says he's had no access to medics.
Las condiciones acá son condiciones inhumanas, ¿sí?
The conditions here are inhumane. We are infected with this virus and there's no solution. Cells that are meant for 6 people have 12, and those meant for 4 have 9 or 10 people.
This video posted online shows some of Juan's cellmates pleading for help. They're desperately trying to keep a fellow prisoner cool. He's clearly in pain and struggling to breathe as a result of COVID-19. Juan, who has underlying health issues, says they don't even have access to the basics.
No, acceso, como dice usted, a jabón y agua, nada. Eso no.
There's no access to soap or water. Water comes just once a day. There's no antibacterial gel and no masks.
No, eso no llega.
Último minuto en noticias RCN.
It was big news when Colombia's Justice Ministry announced it would temporarily release some 4,000 prisoners and place them under house arrest in an effort to curb the spread of the virus. But charity groups immediately pointed out that with such high levels of overcrowding, at least 10 times that number would need to be released to have any impact.
Buenos días. Un saludo cordial a todos los periodistas y medios de comunicación que se encuentran conectados.
Margarita Cabello Blanco is the country's justice minister. She says the authorities are taking appropriate precautions at Villavicencio and at prisons around the country.
We have carried out 2 special large-scale disinfections and we have isolated those over 60. We are doing everything we can, not just in Villavicencio, but everywhere, to avoid the spread of the virus and the death of any inmate, which is really important for us.
Manuel Iturralde, who leads the prison's research group at the University of the Andes in Bogotá, says the measures are too little, too late.
The government should have taken more ambitious measures, especially ordering the release of prisoners, especially those in very vulnerable conditions, disregarding their crimes or the seriousness of their offences, because this is a matter of public health, not of public security.
Families have been demonstrating outside prisons all over the country. Since the nationwide lockdown began in March, prison visits have been banned, so every day in a special WhatsApp group, desperate relatives come together and pray for the safety of their loved ones. Juan's wife says if anything happens to her husband, she'll hold the government and the prison service directly responsible.
We want him to be freed, or at least placed under house arrest. This is to protect him. He has the right to life, and we demand he be given that right.
But Juan, who's still awaiting trial for murder after more than a year inside, is not eligible for early release. For him, the consequences are clear.
La pena de muerte.
They've sentenced us to death, he says.
That report by Matthew Charles in Colombia. A Zimbabwean opposition MP and 2 of her party colleagues are being treated in hospital 2 days after their arrest and subsequent disappearance sparked international concern. The Movement for Democratic Change said Joanna Mamombe and 2 women activists were discovered badly beaten and traumatised near Bindura, about an hour's drive north of Harare. They were arrested on Wednesday after taking part in a protest in Harare against the government's handling of the pandemic in defiance of an official lockdown. Meanwhile, residents of Zimbabwe's second largest city, Bulawayo, have had their running water supply cut to just 1 day a week. The city is grappling with one of its worst water crises in recent history. Fahana Darwood reports.
It's something many of us take for granted, clean running tap water. that is always available. But in Zimbabwe, it's a precious commodity. Reservoir levels have fallen to dangerously low levels due to a severe drought. But for the people of Bulawayo, the situation is absolutely desperate, especially with the need to improve hygiene and hand washing because of the COVID-19 pandemic. For a while now, families have had to trek to unsafe wells as taps run dry. Residents in some suburbs have gone more than a month without receiving any tap water. And now the city council has announced it's decommissioning a third dam. The remaining three reservoirs are only about a third full and water levels continue to fall. So that means from Friday, tap supply is restricted to just once a week. Part of the problem is the country's long-running economic crisis, which has resulted in chronic underinvestment. But renovations to rehabilitate 15 boreholes is reportedly underway after funds were received from the national government. Once complete, it's hoped this will double the current raw water pumping supply.
For Hannah Darwood, the region of Cabo Delgado in northern Mozambique is one of the country's poorest regions, but it's also the scene of an insurgency by Islamist militants, which is rarely mentioned by the government. Now, the Interior Minister has announced that government forces have killed 50 insurgents during fighting and repelled another attack on Thursday. Our Africa regional editor, Mary Harper, told us more.
In this northern province of Mozambique, which is very rich in natural gas, there have been months of Islamist insurgent attacks. And in the recent weeks, they've been particularly dramatic, with the Islamists seizing two key towns. And then Friday, the government of Mozambique made a rare statement on the insurgency, saying that it had killed 50 militants in the last few days of clashes. Normally, the government doesn't say very much about this insurgency that's basically been affecting the north of Mozambique for several years. So it's quite unusual for them to come out and say something. But I suppose the fact that at least they're claiming that they killed 50 militants means they feel comfortable enough to say something about it.
So does this mean that the nature of the insurgency, that the positions of the different parties are changing? Why do you think that they would have come out and said something now?
It's because the insurgency has escalated. It's become more severe, and the big companies that are investing lots of money in these natural gas projects are getting very worried, as are Mozambique's neighbours, particularly Tanzania, just across the border to the north. So I think that the government felt it had to kind of flex its muscles and show that it was doing something. I mean, we had reports not that long ago of these Islamists who call themselves Al-Shabaab but don't seem to have any link to the Somali group Al-Shabaab, that they were raising the black flag of Islamist militancy. And we also had the Islamic State group saying that it was actually responsible for these attacks. So it became slightly more internationalised, and therefore I think the government feels it has to say something at least.
Mary Harper. Facebook is teaming up with telecoms companies to build one of the longest undersea internet cables in the world around the coast of Africa. The 37,000-kilometre line, which will bring faster internet to 16 countries, is part of the social media company's long-running bid to reach young people on the continent. Our technology reporter Jane Wakefield told us more about the project.
It's long wanted to take its social media platform to Africa. I mean, there's a huge population there. There's lots of young people there as well. And it's tried various methods, satellite, etc. This seems to be a long-term bid because this is not going to be cheap. But if it's successful, then it opens up the continent to internet access and it provides Facebook with, you know, up to a billion more users. So it's kind of a win for both in some ways.
And how would this be done?
Undersea cables are used a lot to bring internet to different continents. This is a particularly big effort, though. This cable is going to be 37,000 kilometres long. It will run around the entirety of Africa. And Facebook, along with companies like Vodafone, some African-based telecoms groups as well, are really trying to use the latest technology to make sure they get the best out of this. So it's going to be three times the capacity of all the current undersea cables serving Africa. And one of the issues that these undersea cables have is that sometimes they can be cut by ships, anchors and various other things. So it's going to be buried 50% deeper than previous systems have been done. So they're really trying to make sure that this is future-proofed and it's something that will provide really fast, good internet access for 16 African countries, people in many of those countries of whom won't have had internet access before.
It does raise a few questions, doesn't it, about one huge private company basically owning the access to the internet for quite a lot of the continent. How will it work? What sort of safeguards will there be?
Facebook will be very aware that plans in the past that it's had where it's tried to lock people into a Facebook-only ecosystem have not gone down very well. So let's hope it learns its lessons when this cable is ready for use, which will be in 2024.
2024, that's really soon.
It's not a long time, is it? I mean, these things, I guess, once they get going, they get on with them pretty fast. There's a company, Alcatel, that's going to be laying the cable. Yeah, so for the people and businesses on the continent, it's going to be an exciting time.
Jane Wakefield. Still to come in this podcast.
Reiz ist überhaupt nicht mehr da.
The thrill is gone. Football without spectators isn't football.
The German Bundesliga will resume this weekend under strict conditions, including empty stadiums. In the UK, the government's scientific advisers have warned that the rate at which COVID-19 infections are being passed on has risen slightly. They say the R number is now between 0.7 and 1. It comes as the government raised the prospect that some lockdown measures imposed in England could be eased at different speeds in different regions. Over a 24-hour period, another 384 people have died of the disease in the UK, taking the total to nearly 34,000. Here's our science correspondent, Pallab Ghosh.
The R number is the average number of people an infected person infects. At the start of the epidemic, it was close to 3, and in recent weeks, it had fallen to between 0.5 and 0.9. The revised figure of 0.7 to 1 indicates that the number of new cases is still decreasing, but the rate of decrease is slowing down. Speaking at the Downing Street briefing, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Jenny Harries, explained why the R value might have gone up.
Care homes have been heightened interest, hospitals also, and we keep an eye on those. So this is very much a national average, but it's quite likely in the community across the country that where people have been working really hard on the social distancing measures, that R value will be lower. This is an average across the country.
The fact that the R value is close to one is of concern, as it doesn't take into account the impact of easing lockdown measures this week, especially in England. But the government has taken heart from a new study that shows that the R value is lower in some parts of the country than in others, notably in London. The study has fed into the scientific advisory group's advice to ministers and is likely to have influenced Downing Street's statement that the United Kingdom might ease restrictions at different speeds in different regions. But Dr. Daniela De Angelis of Cambridge University, who is one of the lead researchers, said that such a move now would be premature.
I don't think we should be doing it. Absolutely not. If we relax the restrictions in an inappropriate way, then there is a possibility of a very big second wave.
The idea to have different lockdown measures for different parts of the country was considered by experts at the start of the outbreak, but dismissed because it was thought to be too difficult and draconian to stop movement between different parts of the UK. But now that the disease appears to be under control and that lockdown only needs to be increased in disease hotspots, such a policy is back on the table. A counter-argument, though, is that the R number is currently very close to one and could rise very quickly.
Pallab Ghosh. And staying in Britain, the Prime Minister's office in Downing Street has said that people arriving in the UK from France will not be exempted from a demand that they self-isolate, which has been proposed in order to control the spread of COVID-19. Earlier this week, a joint statement from both countries had said there would be no quarantine measures for travellers from France. Freight drivers are still likely to be allowed to move freely between the UK and France. Here's our business correspondent, Theo Leggett.
Under the new policy, which has yet to be introduced, travellers arriving in the UK will be obliged to isolate themselves for a two-week period. On Monday, the Prime Minister and his French counterpart, President Emmanuel Macron, issued a statement which said that no quarantine measures would apply to travellers coming from France at this stage. The apparent exemption rapidly attracted a warning from the European Commission, which insisted EU members should be treated equally. It was also criticised by some experts as likely to prove unworkable. A spokesman for the Prime Minister insisted there was no exemption, and that the statement referred to cooperation between the two countries that was necessary to manage their common border. It now appears that those excluded from the quarantine plan are likely to include lorry drivers in order to allow the flow of goods to continue, and those working on COVID-19 research, but not ordinary travellers.
Theo Leggett. British and EU negotiators have rounded on each other over what they both say is very scant progress in talks on Britain's future relationship with the bloc. Britain's chief Brexit negotiator David Frost accused the EU of trying to force Britain to abide by EU rules. The EU's chief Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier said Britain and the Prime Minister Boris Johnson had not engaged in proper talks about a fair trade arrangement.
The United Kingdom has not got into a real discussion on the question of the level playing field, whatever it says. It's the rules of fair play for the economy and trade, which we agreed on with Boris Johnson in the political declaration, which remains a relevant document for today and the future. On this subject, it was a range of diverging views without any progress.
Michel Barnier. The European Union has indicated it will try to stop a possible Israeli annexation of parts of the occupied West Bank. Our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston reports.
The European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, made clear he opposed any unilateral action being taken with regard to the West Bank. He said the EU would use all its diplomatic capacity to prevent that. President Trump has put forward proposals for the region which envisage Israeli annexation of parts of the occupied territory. The idea is bitterly opposed by the Palestinians, who want the West Bank for a state of their own.
Alan Johnston. The city authorities in Moscow have launched a mass screening program to tackle one of the world's worst ongoing outbreaks of the coronavirus. It plans to check 20,000 people a day to build up a clearer picture of how far coronavirus has spread. Sarah Rainsford reports.
36 clinics across Moscow are now collecting blood samples from residents selected at random and invited by text message. A laboratory has the results ready the next day. Russian doctors believe the method, known as IFA, is more accurate than rapid testing with a finger prick. It can detect the antibodies produced when someone has been sick and recovered, but also those that appear if they're fighting a new infection. Those people who may not have symptoms of coronavirus can then be isolated. Nasal and throat swabs for COVID-19 itself are also being taken and tested for everyone just in case.
Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. The Belgian football club Brugge has been formally declared champion of the National League, which ended prematurely because of the pandemic. Brugge had a 15-point lead with one match left to play. It's the club's 17th title. Elsewhere, the German Bundesliga will resume this weekend under strict conditions, including empty stadiums and twice-a-week testing for players. The first high-profile match is between Borussia Dortmund and local rivals Schalke. Jenny Hill sent this report from Dortmund.
With his black and yellow football scarf draped around his neck, a man heaves chairs into widely spaced rows in front of a big screen. Oliver runs one of Dortmund's fan clubs. Ordinarily, they'd be cheering from the stands this weekend. Instead, they'll be watching in this hall from a distance.
Der Reiz ist überhaupt nicht mehr da.
The thrill is gone. Football without spectators isn't football.
Dortmund has a shot at winning the league, but still Oliver can't get excited.
Aus unserer Sicht, von der Fanseite und auch gerade von den
traditionellen We traditional fans, who object to the commercial aspect of football, think it completely wrong to restart the league. That has nothing to do with football.
Für uns nichts mehr von mit Fußball zu tun.
Dortmund's team in training and in quarantine before their match. Players and staff at other clubs have tested positive in recent weeks. Some have broken isolation and self-distancing rules. There's still no guarantee the season won't be called off again. Meanwhile, Dortmund's amateur pitches are still out of bounds. A groundsman on a tractor painstakingly putters back and forth over the AstroTurf at SF Brackel as coach Mike Kalender looks on.
Ich finde das sehr gut, weil ich glaube, dass viele Menschen.
I think it's great that they're restarting the league. People need entertainment, and sports people are a bit like gladiators. They help distract us from worries about the coronavirus and money.
Mike will actually be at the Bundesliga match, one of a few workers allowed into the so-called ghost game.
A ghost game will be a unique experience, something to tell the kids about.
In a warm rehearsal room backstage, three dancers from the Dortmund Theatre bend and stretch and spin. Above them, a sign reminds them to keep their distance. This country is taking tentative steps towards a new normality, but surveys suggest a majority of Germans think it's too soon for football, and there's still no live ballet, opera, theatre.
For a dancer, I think this should also be the same measures as football, because it doesn't matter whether it's football or ballet, it should be treated the same way.
Sayaka Wakita hopes she'll be able to perform again soon.
The dancers' careers are very, very short, right? So as opposed to a normal career that you can maybe work for 40 years, our dancers' careers maximum 20 years.
As Germany's top flight players prepare for their return to the limelight, some have taken part in public health adverts, urging people to maintain social distancing measures. Many fear their fans may not listen this weekend.
Jenny Hill in Germany. Astrid Kircher, the photographer whose shots of the Beatles helped turn them into icons, has died in Germany aged 81. David Sillitoe assesses her legacy.
It was in Hamburg that the Beatles truly learned their craft and developed their image. And the person who caught it on camera was a 22-year-old photographer, Astrid Kircher. The moody black-and-white shots taken at a fairground of a brill-creamed and bequiffed Lennon and McCartney were some of the first photos of the Beatles. She had never encountered rock and roll before, and they were equally confounded by her friends' strange haircuts. It wasn't long before she was taking scissors to the quiffs and styling what became known as the Beatles' mop top.
David Sillitoe reporting. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. Drop us an email if you'd like to. It's globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And we will leave you with something rather nice, sent in by listener Rob Cook from Long Island, New York. He thinks it's a northern mockingbird. Thanks for that, Rob. I'm Jackie Leonard. Until next time, goodbye.